GTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have just finished reading a book that really reminds me of the unique power and poignancy of a beautifully written memoir. And this particular memoir is called One-Legged Mongoose, Secrets, Legacies, and Coming of Age in 1950s New York. This is a book written by Mark J. Strauss, who for most of his professional life was a medical oncologist, also, though, an art collector, writer, poet, and in this book, he turns away from the scientific writing that he has done or his articles about contemporary art or his poetry to write the story of his childhood growing up in New York City. And it is an absolutely beautifully rendered book, at times hilariously funny, at certain times painfully poignant and even tragic. And so much of the world in which he lives as a youngster, 1950s in New York City, comes vividly to life. And we are viewing it through his perspective as a young boy, eventually a young man in a Jewish family, trying to make sense of all that is going on around him. The book is published by Greenpoint Press, again titled One-Legged Mongoose, Secrets, Legacies, and Coming of Age in 1950s New York. And Mark J. Strauss, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
I really have enjoyed this book thoroughly. It's a book that, in a sense, it took you a long time to write, and in particular, it took you a long time to share with the world. I wonder if you would begin by explaining a request that was made to you by your younger brother in terms of the circumstances under which you would share this memoir with the world.
Yes. Stephen, who's an essential character in this book, was a very delicate, brilliant kid who needed protection. And later he grew up to become a well-known scientist and clinician. He had asked me for many years not to publish this book until my mother passed away. And I honored that request and actually really started it after she had died.
So you had thought about writing such a memoir, but actually waited until her death to actually sit down and do the writing of it.
That's correct.
And we should probably at least briefly touch on the fact that part of why your younger brother was reluctant for this book to be written while your mother was alive was because of the rather difficult relationship that you had with her, and in particular the really sad reality of the beatings that she sometimes inflicted on you. I assume that was the primary source of his concern, that if you wrote a book that shared openly about that, it might be painful or embarrassing for her.
Yes, it's true. I had an older sister, have an older sister, Miriam. Of course, she's important in the book. And Stephen, who was 3 years younger. But I really think this opened wounds for both of them. This book is narrated by the kid between the ages of 10 and 12. And that was really the only way I knew how to write this properly, be in that space again. And my mother, who was an extraordinarily brilliant woman, might have been one of the great pianists in the world if she kept at it, beat me relentlessly from before the age of two. And we see near the close of the book, when I've just turned 12, I'm trying to end this. And it was an extraordinary childhood in many ways, but she never beat my brother or sister. My brother, I simply wouldn't let her.
And so it was at your younger brother's insistence that you waited until your mother had died before actually sitting down and writing this book. And you go on to tell us that sadly your brother died of cancer, and so he did not live to see the release of this book.
No, I really feel terribly about that. He became head of virology at the National Institutes of Health. I think we'd be seeing him on TV a lot these days if he were. And later he became the first director of the National Institute of Complementary and Alternative Medicine. We get a sense he's headed in that direction when he's a very little kid. And I'm really proud of what he did. I was actually with part of his family yesterday, and I think it's going to be interesting for his kids and his grandchildren eventually to read this.
You say in the author's note at the very beginning of the book, the only way I knew to tell this story was in the voice of the boy who lived it as he lived it, to let my younger self speak. I wonder if you could explain how you went about trying to achieve that. And I should add that I think you did achieve it. I mean, it really is as though we are listening to the musings of a 10-year-old or 11-year-old or 12-year-old who is actually living through these experiences. But in a sense, what did you have to do as a writer to achieve that? And how different did this feel from any of the writing you had done before this?
My scientific writing was, of course, very matter-of-fact, and I learned how to do that. I had an important component of being able to do this was I started writing poetry seriously in my mid-40s, and I just had this need to do it. And the work was somewhat autobiographical, but what I began to realize, it came from this unconscious space. These poems weren't really planned. I really needed that experience first. And writing memoirs, almost every memoir is written in the voice of the adult, looking back. And some of my good writer friends all argued with me that was the only way to do it. I tried to do that once. It was completely unsuccessful. I have an extraordinary memory that I didn't really understand until I began college and found out what it was like to cram the last minute. And in this book, when I begin to think about an episode and I'm back in that place in my head, the kid speaks. I could see it and hear it, and it needed this authentic voice. You can't manufacture, well, maybe some writers are good enough, like Mary Carr, but you can't manufacture the voice of the kid otherwise.
We're speaking with Mark J. Strauss about his newly published memoir called One-Legged Mongoose, Secrets, Legacies, and Coming of Age in 1950s New York. Before we dig into some of the specific experiences that you chronicle in your memoir, why don't we set the scene for our listeners by having you describe, just in the most basic sort of fashion, your family, the family in which you grew up, and the neighborhood in which you grew up?
Mine was a first-generation American family. My dad left the Ukraine in poverty at age 15. He came over. His mother died when he was 3 months old. And he went to work 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. Very smart man. And by his 20s, he opened a textile store on the Lower East Side and worked really hard. My mother was brilliant, didn't have a college education. This was a person who would have been probably quite different if she had the possibilities that women have today, but it was rare then. My older sister, Miriam, was in the family, of course, and my younger brother, Stephen. And the book opens up in when I turn 10, and my dad announces to us without explanation that Stephen and I are transferring from Long Island School to a religious yeshiva in Queens, and it meant Stephen and I would commute 4 hours a day. And that happened without explanation. This book takes place at a moment when we had the politics of the McCarthy hearings. We had the end of the Korean War. And I began to work at my dad's store Sundays when I was 5, and I loved it. And I kept doing that pretty much till the end of medical school. And he was completely quiet at home, a totally different character in the store, and I was the one who got to know him. And on the way to the store, he'd be yelling at the windshield about politics. So I learned a lot.
One thing that is intriguing about your father and the way you describe him is that your father was a very, very quiet man, at least most of the time. But you describe that quiet, that silence, in a couple of different ways. At the opening of one chapter, you say, most of the time at home, Dad is like Harpo Marx, silent. There is another point much later in the book in which you describe your father as being as still as a quiet lake. And at another point, you say you realized eventually that your father spoke mostly in silences. And I just think that's really interesting that you found different ways to describe his silence, his quietness, as though it had different faces or different facets. Tell us more about his quietness, when he was quiet or under what circumstances, and ultimately what you came to understand about why he was as quiet a man as he was.
In his store, which was a place of great comfort for him, he was an extraordinary gregarious salesperson, and I just learned a lot. Home, my mother was so dominant that he had very little to say, and most of the time he said nothing, although, of course, he had strong opinions. But some of the quiet, which I don't say in the book because I only understood so much as a 10 to 12-year-old, some of the silences I think comes from his childhood. There's a moment in the book when he has this book near him and he opens it, and there's a photograph, an old photograph of a bunch of school kids lined up for pictures, all in some kind of uniform. And he points to it and says, "All dead." And he's pointing to a group of the kids, the Jewish kids in his town, who all died. in the Holocaust. And these were kids who were killed by the local people in the town. And I think part of it is my father never forgave himself that he survived and they didn't.
Hmm. You write, after going back and forth with him to the store hundreds of times, I know that he mostly speaks in silences. In that moment, I knew he felt guilty that he was alive and they were dead, and it was too late to correct it. No matter what he did, the ending would always be the same. What I read is almost all fiction, make-believe, but this is real, and there is no forgetting the end. What is intriguing about that is that somewhere else in the book, you touch on the fact that the Holocaust was rather seldom spoken about, at least in open fashion. And I don't remember now exactly the circumstances under which that seemed to bewilder you. But help us understand how much you knew about the Holocaust and to what extent that was a largely unspoken reality.
I was a prolific reader. I was reading tremendous numbers of books at an early age, and that was part of my life. And I had this wonderful woman at the library who would hold two books for me every week, but I got into the available literature when I went to the library on the Holocaust. I read everything I could. And surely when I was in public school for 5 years, it wasn't mentioned. There were very, very few Jewish kids where we grew up. But I was bewildered that going to an all-Jewish school where we're learning Jewish history and Talmud, not a word was spoken, including synagogue. I went on later to a Jewish high school, same thing. I don't think there was a Holocaust course at a university in the United States until about 30-something years after the Holocaust. It was something that even the Jewish community didn't talk about. And then it began to change.
Mm. You write, I was born during the Holocaust, which no one in this Jewish school ever discusses, not Rabbi Rosenstein or Rabbi Charney or in Temple on Saturday. It, like it's a secret, like it never happened, like those piles of dead bodies are just pictures in books. I read about the ghettos and expulsions, and all Jews know, whether they admit it or not, that the Holocaust will be the single defining moment for us for at least 1,000 years. It follows Dad like a constant shadow. And I, just to be clear, you had this insight even then as a youngster. That's not just you decades later looking back.
In some ways it angered me. And we see in this book, although it's not specifically to the Holocaust, that the difficulty I had with some of the history we were being taught, some of the things we were being taught by Talmud teachers. There's a moment when one of the Talmud teachers said something that was really anti-Christian, and I got incensed, and I thought, he's no different than the people who are anti-Semitic. And he and I really went at it in the class. So I think that, you know, it's interesting, all the way through college and more, I don't think Jews wanted to talk about it. And then it's a very difficult thing. There were questions that were asked, of course, you know, did the Jews have to die? Should they have fought back? And it's almost a useless question. But we were at a different time in America, And it was also a time when it was very difficult for Jews to get into good universities, difficult to get into good law schools and medical schools. And I think it needed decades for this kind of self-awareness. And it's happened, thank goodness.
Let's talk about your mother. And you have already touched on the fact that she was a brilliant woman, brilliantly talented in particular. She was an extraordinarily talented pianist, and there is every possibility that she could have been a professional pianist with absolutely spectacular potential. But she quit studying piano at the age of 15. And you suggest that there is a bit of mystery that surrounds just why that happened, although it may have simply been the circumstances of the Great Depression. But how do you tie that, if you do, to the way she treated you, to the angry outbursts that led to frequent beatings? Do you feel like there is a connection there?
Oh, that's a good question. There probably is. I was very, very close to her father until he died when I was 5. He was the closest person in my life. And then I was close with her mother, Grandma Katie, who's important in the book. She hated her mother. And to see that was really awful for a kid. She treated her mother terribly. And there's a moment in the book, there's a moment that happened when I was younger, and I finally told my mother, I'm going to tell my father. And she begged me not to, and at one moment she tells me, you don't know about my childhood. There may be some truth to that, but I never really knew. In the book, her brother, Uncle High, worked in my dad's store, and I became close with him. So I learned some of it. But even later, I didn't know. I knew that at age 15, she left high school in almost at the end of her senior year because she had to go out and make money. And she went out and helped make a living for the family. But she gave up the piano. And some of it may have been the anger that her mother made her go out and clean houses when she was 12 and 13. But ultimately, I didn't know. And, you know, later in life, my mother would watch a game show. She'd get all the questions right. And I told her, what's the point? Go back to college. You know, do it. And finally, at age 71, she went back to college, graduated with straight A's, which I would have expected. But she was part of that generation, and she didn't really know how to overcome it. Part of the problem, I believe, today is she was really bipolar, and she needed help, and she needed medication. And she would always refuse to get evaluated.
She is described in someone else's account, and I don't remember now who it was, but I think it's a relative who maybe wrote her own memoir or something about her, described your mother as a painfully intelligent woman. Take us behind what you think those intriguing words mean.
She had a sense just how brilliant she was, and she was. She was the leader of this Jewish women's group, and of course raised the most money, and of course had a firm grip on what every single person had to do. She once told me that she was going to work at my dad's store she would surely be able to sell the most. And I thought, God Almighty, keep her out of the store. You know, that's my dad's sanctuary. I began to get Carnegie tickets later in life. And I told her once, it was around 1991, I now have heard a pianist as good as you. Can you imagine? She said, not possible. But she gave it up. I think that she had so much anger, and she couldn't constructively use her anger. We just see this in an extraordinary number of people who have the potential to do things that they simply don't do.
Are not able to do or not allowed
They're
to
not
do.
We're not allowed to do. Mm-hmm. Her piano teacher wound up trying to teach me piano, but I had no interest and I was hopeless. But he told me, you wait a whole lifetime to get a student like her, and then she gave it up. Mm-hmm.
We're speaking with Mark J. Strauss, and we're talking about his book, One-Legged Mongoose, Secrets, Legacies, and Coming of Age in 1950s New York. One of the most central and significant themes of the book is your relationship with your younger brother, Stephen, who needs your protection. You are convinced of this, and from the way you describe it, it's probably true. Tell us more about Stephen and why he was, in a sense, such a tempting target for bullies, and the extent to which you were willing to go to shield him from harm.
I think some kids are that way. I think it was exacerbated enormously by the terror in our home. He was a slight kid. He was thin and didn't eat much, and he was always in his own head. He'd go out in the garage and he'd build things all day, and I never knew what the hell they were, but I used to procure his wooden nails for him. And he witnessed these beatings, and he'd just get down on the floor and cover his head and scream. I had a sense that I could survive it, but he couldn't, and I'm sure that's true. But I think it also damaged him because he was there and he couldn't. It's just the kind of kid that bullies smell, and they take advantage of that kid. That kind of kid. It's everywhere, and it's awful. And so we were in a Long Island neighborhood with few Jews, and it was very, very anti-Semitic, and kids would get him, and they'd beat him up. It became impossible for me to get revenge in front of Stephen. It would be too embarrassing for him. So I'd wait. And whenever I got any of them alone, I beat them up, and it would end it. And after a while, it was so routine, I once beat up a kid who didn't do anything. But it continued, and I thought, oh, my God, we're going to go to Queens, New York, and Jamaica. It's going to be worse. But he found a home there. There were kids like him. There were brainy, bookish kids who didn't fight. And my brother really stayed that way, but in a very good way. As a professional, he knew how to understand and accommodate people. But I grew up being extraordinarily angry whenever I saw bullying.
Hmm. One thing that is interesting about the way you describe your relationship with Stephen and this role of protector in which you saw yourself, is that it went beyond his vulnerability. It also involved who he was and what he was meant to do. Towards the end of the book, you describe what it turns out to be a pretty savage beating that is committed by a young man in the neighborhood named Joey, who and it was very clearly an anti-Semitic attack on Stephen, and unfortunately you were not around. You write, "Had I been there, he would never have been hurt. No one will ever hit him when I am around. The neighborhood boys all know the consequences. It is my job to protect him. I knew it the first time I saw him, when Mom brought him home from the hospital and put him on the kitchen table for me to see. He was so small and helpless. He is not meant to fight. He is meant for dreaming of tiny things and building huge things no one ever understands." I think there are plenty of older brothers who would look after a younger brother and serve this role of protector, but I'm not sure how many older brothers would necessarily see their younger brother in that particular way, as more than just someone who's kind of a shrimp who can't fight for himself and needs to be protected. But you saw something beyond that. You saw the potential of what Stephen was meant to be and what he was meant to do, and you wanted to be sure that he had a chance to do that. Am I summarizing that fairly?
Yeah, really. When we were on the train so many hours a day for so many years, I started buying him first electronic magazines, then I bought him issues of Scientific American. And my God, he would go through Scientific American and read it cover to cover and understand it. And I wasn't interested in any of that stuff. I mean, I wasn't, I guess, surprised many years later. What did he really do? He became a researcher and a virologist. He was, after all, working on things we couldn't see. And his first science publication was with me, and working with him was very interesting. He was extraordinarily meticulous. There were other things that he knew and he didn't know about in the rest of his life, where I had quietly done something or protected him. The one thing which I failed at was he had brain cancer, and I stepped in and was part of the group who treated him, and I oversaw everything, and it didn't work. I mean, he lived much longer than average, but he didn't make it. Hmm.
He sounds like an extraordinary man, and I am so touched by the relationship that the two of you had for all of your lives. Among the most important events in your life is what occurs when you contract poliomyelitis, and of course that was such an incredibly terrifying experience for so many families in this era in the early 1950s. Was it hard to relive that experience as you wrote about it in this book?
I think it was easier in the sense that I was there. I had the naivete of a kid when I wrote it. I was back again on the top of the landing when I tried to go walk downstairs in the summer, and my feet couldn't hold me up, and I had no idea what it was. I simply couldn't walk, and it happened very quickly. It didn't take long that we understood it was polio. There were kids dying in our neighborhood, kids who had died. I saw a girl taken out in an iron lung. And I had this fatalistic sense throughout my childhood that you can change what's going to happen. You just have to do the best when you're up against something and not let it beat you if that's possible. So I was put on total bed rest for 2 months. I knew I still had feeling in my legs. I wasn't strong enough to get out.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Get through.
One of the hardest things was figuring out what to do with your time when you were unable to do all of the things that you would be typically doing as a very, very active boy. You write it at one point, the dictionary says dolor, D-O-L-O-R, means mental suffering. Mental suffering is lying in bed for 6 weeks and only getting out to go to the bathroom. You never think about how you spend your time until you are so limited. I really can't imagine. And, of course, you were far from alone in terms of being a young person whose life was suddenly so drastically shrunk. And on top of it, none of your school friends visited, most likely because their parents were afraid that they might contract this illness from you. How did you manage to endure that as well as you did?
In the belief that I didn't get worse, that as long as I didn't get worse, it was just a matter of time. And I was a kid who knew how to bide my time. I endured it in part because I was back in my world of books. It was harder to read because there was nothing else to do but read. But books were, you know, an enormous help, and just a sense. It's just like, you know, the terrible part about being beaten, just the sense when it happened, I'd go into a different place in my head and disappear because I would know it would end. So it was a similar sense that this is going to end, and it's going to be behind me.
In this same chapter or section of the book called Comeback Kid, you also tell us about a really nasty accident that you suffered, a really unhappy encounter with a fence that could have ended even worse than it did. Describe to our listeners the accident that I'm talking about.
Well, after I had polio, I mean, I was a kid who made accidents happen, I think. Not this one. I looked for trouble. You know, I looked to fight several people at once. But after I was allowed to get out of bed, the doctor, I said I could go to camp for the last 2 weeks. Stephen was already there. And I thought, well, this is useless. I don't know anybody. But I went to camp with 2 weeks to go, and I was really weakened. And I began to get stronger very quickly. I just worked at it. And we had color war where, you know, towards the end of the camp, there's one color against another color. And I participated as best I could. But then right at the end of color war, I had made a date to play the best tennis player in the group. And I went down to this crappy court and kind of decided to hit some balls. And I dropped the ball, and I leaned over near the fence to pick it up, and my eye got caught on a wire that was sticking out. And I couldn't extricate myself. My God, I remember it moment by moment, even now. And this is the first time I was that consciously frightened in my entire life. Nobody came. I yelled, and I yelled, and I knew I can't stay here forever. If I pull off, you know, maybe I'm going to be blind, and I didn't know what to do. So finally, because I knew I needed help, I pulled off the fence, and there was this enormous tearing, and then I was bleeding like hell. And the rest of the story, the people who ran the camp were just horrible. I mean, even today, I wound up taking a bus by myself from Pennsylvania back to New York. I had called my dad and asked him to get me an eye surgeon, which he did. So there I was on the bus with a rag with blood on my face, and I endured the ride back until we arrived at night. And then the next day I underwent surgery. Mm.
Comeback kid indeed. And fortunately you emerged from that in about as good a fashion as you could have hoped. And it's just one more of the bumps along the way. I want to be sure that we give you a couple of minutes to talk about another of the threads that is woven through this this memoir, that along with all of the chess matches and fights defending your brother and horseplay and so on, there is also all of this religious study. And you are growing up in a household that is not very religious at all. And so this is something that in some ways you are very reluctant to enter this world of study of the Talmud and so on. And yet it ends up being, I think it's safe to say, far more meaningful for you than you would have ever imagined it could be. Tell us in particular about this text that you studied. It was one of 63 volumes of Talmudic Jewish law. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Baba
yes.
Kama? Which
Baba
is
Kama.
Which to you was just about cows. And cows and meadows and you eventually realized that it was about far more than that. Explain.
Well, I didn't want to go to the school. It was ironic that I hoped they would turn me down, but I had to take Hebrew lessons and get approved by the end of the summer, and I did the Hebrew lessons. So, you know, it was just a great teacher that made the difference, and then I studied. But when I got there, I learned that beginning fifth grade, the boys only studied Talmud a half a day in original Aramaic. I mean, I hardly knew Hebrew. It's a quasi-different language, but that's what the Talmud was written in. And I come into class, and they begin with this text that's maybe one of the easier ones, and it's just completely foreign. And, you know, this rabbi is teaching it. We begin with this whole argument that what happens if a cow goes across into a neighbor's yard and gores the neighbor's cow and kills it, does he have to pay recompense? And I said, well, I mean, why are we studying this nonsense? But then every time you thought you were nearing a solution, there's an exception. And then you think, okay, this is going to be the... And then there's an exception. And after a while, I began to realize, and especially the headmaster, Rabbi Charney, who really took me under his wings, it's really not relevant because it's ancient law. It's about how we're trying to achieve balance and fairness and how you really have to think about the contingencies and circumstances that you might not have thought about. And that's what's relevant. And I began to love it. I didn't love all the teachers, but I love the discipline. And I wouldn't be the first one who would say, who's been through it and went on to other professions, probably most demanding thing I've ever studied.
Hmm. You write towards the end of the book, Talmud is not about cows goring cows anymore. It is about how ideas branch out to more ideas. And just when you might be considering what seems fair for one person, you realize how that decision might impact someone else. Fairness is a delicate balance without absolutes. And I think what you're saying is that the study of Talmud takes us to that place. One of your rabbis told you, you think it's laws about cows. No, it's the beginning of a discipline to learn to think independently, to ask questions, to not take simple answers at face value. I suspect that that is something that you hold very close to you to this very day.
Interesting that when the pandemic broke out, I had this complete freedom. I just didn't go anywhere for about 7 months. Never had that my whole adult life. And I wrote the drafts of two novels, and I've gone back and pretty much finished them. And one called The Judge, and this just came out of my unconscious, takes place, half of it takes place around the time of Jesus. And there's the Jewish Sanhedrin, and of course the law is Talmudic law. And yes, when used as it was meant to be, I have great reverence for it. I mean, we see in many communities that it becomes a thing unto itself. And I sometimes think we've forgotten its full purpose.
This is just one aspect of this wonderful memoir in which you describe so many interesting chapters of your life and experience. And we meet some very, very memorable people. And eventually you find yourself wanting to turn away from what you call unnecessary fights. And so we make this journey with you to a place of, in a sense, new maturity. And it makes us hope that maybe there'll be another memoir coming from you. Do you think about the possibility of telling us more about your life as you go on into the teenage years, or is this likely it?
No, it's not it. It's just a question. It's just an enormous amount of work. And I love writing. Before I wrote this memoir, I had a very good draft of a memoir of the year, 1 year that I was five. And once again, I remembered so much. But then I think I made a decision, and I had some really good advice. I had begun this one, you know, finish this one, do it as best as I can, and I'm really happy with it. And then perhaps I'll go back to the five-year-old one, which I call the pea shooter. And, you know, I was in the same town. That's the year my grandfather died. But I did start another book, and I don't know what's going to happen with it because, you know, I don't want to wind up writing four or five memoirs. But I started the book beginning age 13 when I start 14 when I start in high school, and I have a bunch of it written that needs a lot. That book is called The Ethiopian.
Very good. Well, we are glad that you gave the world this memoir, One-Legged Mongoose, Secrets, Legacies, and Coming of Age in 1950s New York, published by Greenpoint Press, and the author, Mark J. Strauss. Mark J. Strauss, it was great to speak with you about your fascinating book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you very much.